Hi, I'm Kristen Bell. Carvana makes car buying easy. Isn't that right, hun? Dax? Dax?
Sorry, did you know about this 7-day money-back guarantee?
A week to evaluate seat comfiness, you say?
A week of terrain tests? Yeah, I can test the brake pad resistance at variable speeds.
Make sure all the kids' stuff fits nicely.
Make sure our stuff fits nicely.
Oh, the...
Right. Still need to buy the car. Getting ahead of ourselves here.
Buy your car with Carvana today.
I'm Dan.
And I'm Alex, and welcome back, everyone, to On Air, still ranking in the top 1% globally, wherever you get your podcasts, and that is all thanks to you guys. So thank you for being here along with us for the ride. Happy Wednesday, Dan. How are you?
Happy Wednesday. I'm good. I'm in Sweden, and I'm trying to think if besides, I think we recorded like 2 episodes ever where I've happened to be in Sweden on a Wednesday.
Yeah.
And the one that I remember is the first episode we ever recorded.
Oh,
I was
wow.
here during the summer, and it's so funny to think back. I was nervous. I was like, oh my God, we're going completely off script. Just have to talk for 45 minutes and sound intelligent. Now I realize that's... You know, I just have to accept that that's hard for me, but I embrace it anyway. But it's even harder for you.
Whoa. We have been nice to each other for 1 minute, 17 seconds so far. That includes the time we started recording. Let us not get off to any wrong track so far. You're in Sweden. I'm in Hamburg, not too far away. So close to Copenhagen, I can almost see it.
I know.
Beautiful weather here, but very cold compared to everywhere else I've been in Europe over the last week.
Yeah.
But
next week,
so
well, do you want to tell people why you're there?
I am here for a lot of the aviation sector globally gather here for this conference, Aircraft Interiors Expo, Passenger Travel Expo, World Catering, something, basically the entire kind of aviation ecosystem on display, suppliers meeting. With you know, you've got all of the vendors, the suppliers, you have the delegations of airlines, of manufacturers, of whatever, roaming around, you know, securing and signing deals, and everyone, crucially, and I guess of most interest to me, showing off the latest and greatest that will eventually end up in aircraft that we will then, you know, fly on or hear from you guys, the listeners, that you've flown on them. So a lot of that journey before they enter commercial service starts here, where they show the industry what's next, what's coming up.
Yeah, you know, that's the difference between you and me. You go to an expo to try the seats. I try them on the plane.
Yeah, the difference between you and me is that you try them on the plane on a commercial flight, whereas there's a 90% chance I flew that on the delivery. So let's not go down that route. Why am I sensing you're in a funny mood on this episode?
I'm feeling sassy. I don't know why, but...
Well, we can start again, because according to the UK, I don't know if you saw this when the Heathrow meltdown happened. Did you see what they said SAS was, Scandinavian Airlines?
Oh my gosh, yes. And we forgot to talk about this when we discussed the meltdown.
So this was Sky News, right? And for the record, I was not broadcasting with them that day, so nothing to do with it, because it wouldn't have happened if I was there. But they had obviously typed in into Google, you know, what is SAS, when SAS released a statement to basically say that, like every other airline, they were cancelling flights that day. And of course, when they had Googled what is SAS, whichever junior person searched that, they came back with, yeah, you know, the SAS, as in, like, you know, a branch of the special forces. And so that's what they said on Sky News. They said that the SAS, you know, a branch of the special forces in the UK, have cancelled their flights to and from London Heathrow. It's like, would they let you know about that? I don't think so.
No, I loved that so much, because you know that on air we love making fun of SAS, of Gothenburg.
Don't drag me into it. I've got nothing to do with that. This is just your childhood trauma.
You know, I was at Gothenburg Airport a few days ago, enjoying the efficiency of being outside the airport 5 minutes after I touched down, which you don't
get. I could do that at major
Heathrow
hubs.
Well, yes, depending on, you know, your special perks, but I may have seen Alex drive away on a golf cart a few weeks ago as we waved into the horizon.
You have woken up this morning, young man, and chosen violence. Okay.
Well, let's redirect that. Let's redirect the violence towards something we both feel some disappointment toward.
And something that we both can be violent about.
Yeah, that is Singapore Changi Airport, which everyone will be shocked to hear us say. We forgot to tell this story last week, so here we are. The story is fully in the flesh, and we have a little bit of beef with Changi Airport. Who would have thought?
Yeah, so firstly, when you look at the world's best airports globally, and everyone's very familiar with the names, really, the number one spot, as recognized by Skytrax, who one way or another have found themselves being the most dominant in the industry in terms of their rating system and what they award, it kind of switches every couple of years, every few years, between Singapore Changi, who I think are the most awarded in the top spot, and Doha Hamad International Airport. And so between Doha HIA and Singapore Changi, it kind of, as I said, depending on the year, goes between either, which sometimes I think there is a little strategy there also, as in from Skytrax, because I guess it keeps both keen, right? But the expectation when you are traveling through an airport that is perhaps the most awarded world's best airport, Singapore Changi, I mean, the expectations are pretty high. But also, you have to be realistic. And I think both you and I are examples of realistic travelers. We have flown all over the world and we know what to expect and what not to expect in different scenarios. Which brings us to 7 a.m. weekday Changi Airport, right? So we check in, you pull up, it's super efficient. And I'll do like the first bit of the story, Dan, and then you do the you do the middle. And stuff.
I just want to like paint the picture here of the you, me, and Oscar pulling up to Changi, bright eyed and excited, or just like
this bright eyed and bushy tailed.
Yeah, and you were literally like, Dan, I think we need to leave an hour earlier just to enjoy Changi. And
I want to enjoy it. Yeah,
and I'm just like, no, true. I always prioritize sleep. And you're like, no, Dan, this is, we don't know when we'll be in Singapore again together. And I'm like, ugh, fine. So
it's true. Like to align our schedules is going to be difficult. And also, it wasn't like it was the crack of dawn. I mean, it was seven. So I was like, that's fine. Yeah.
Yeah. So we pull up and we're just ready to make the most out of Changi. So what happens? Yeah.
So first thing we decided we're going to do is we're going to drop our bags. And many people who are flying from Changi will be familiar with this, because if you go and check in your bags, then you have time to enjoy the jewel, Singapore's jewel, the state-of-the-art vortex and incredible mall, a green tropical oasis with restaurants, cafes, retail, high-end shopping, grocery stores, but also the unbelievably impressive water vortex that kind of comes down the middle, and you've got the passenger monorail passing by behind. So of course, you know, we said, given that we're both there, let's make sure that we have time to enjoy it. So we go to the Qatar Airways check-in, we check in our bags, and that's all fine. We then say, okay, let's go to the Jewel first before we go airside. Now, for anyone that hasn't been through Singapore either ever or has forgotten because it's been a while, you do not go through security centrally at Singapore. So you don't proceed to security after check-in. Instead, after check-in, your option is to hang out in the Jewel, which is, as I said, this separate, massive kind of mall-like structure that is literally steps away from the check-in desks, or to go through immigration, flash your passport. Again, extremely efficient. It is just, I wish we could replicate that model everywhere else. And then through security, and then, sorry, not through security. Once you're through immigration, you're in departure, where you've got, well, we'll come to that, what you've got. But anyway, so Dan, take it away. We're ready now for the vortex, right? I can't wait to have this moment that's like that reel that went viral of the person seeing Big Ben, and she falls to her knees and she's like, and it's playing that song.
What's the song? I forgot already.
I don't want
to
sing it.
No, you have to.
No, the song. She falls to her knees and it's like, This is what dreams, that one.
Yeah, some Disney's are, this is what dreams are made of. So, oh yeah, it goes, hey now.
We're ready
hey
for that now. Kind of moment. That's it.
Yeah. So, we were literally walking behind Alex, expecting him to drop to his knees and start bowing to the waterfall.
Wouldn't have happened, but I was genuinely looking forward to it.
Yeah. And we're like, it's eerily quiet here. Why is it so, like, you could hear a pin drop.
And now, by the way, it's about 8, isn't it? But by the time we sorted everything and went to the jewel, it's about 8 in the morning.
Yeah.
Which 8 o'clock in my world is like, yalla, everyone's up.
Yeah.
Right?
Well, depends where you are, but certainly okay, in some parts of the world. Anyway, so we turn the corner to the beautiful, green, luscious gardens of the jewel, and the waterfall is not on. And we go, all right, so we walk closer and closer, and there's a little schedule on the railing that says, the waterfall is open at 11 a.m. And we go, now it's 8, and our flight is at 10, so no waterfall for us today. Which, well,
I don't remember the conversation being quite like that. I remember about 15 minutes of me in sheer disbelief saying to you both, 11? 11? How does anything start at 11 in the morning? That is lunchtime. 9? I could have gotten on board with, 9:30 a bit. Still think it's unacceptable. But 11 in a 24-hour hub like Changi?
I think we should find a way to blame Big Check-In for this. They have those shady jewel check-in desks right next to the waterfall.
Written all over it.
They have gradually expanded the number of airlines that let you check in at Jewel. So they try to lure people in with their big check-in desks. But then Big Check-In doesn't want to pay for the people who check in early to actually have anything to do at Jewel. Because
I think you're onto something.
Not only is the waterfall closed, then we head out into the mall and every single shop, cafe, restaurant is closed. And not only that, most escalators are turned off.
We're switched
at
off.
8 a.m.
It was a ghost town. So between 8 a.m. and 9 a.m. at Changi. And remember that Changi doesn't really have peaks as prominent as the Gulf hubs. So for example, where everything is banked, if you're flying through Dubai, Abu Dhabi, Doha, even now Riyadh and other GCC airports, everything is kind of banked where, it's really, really busy in the night around 1 a.m. Then they have that kind of second peak about 4, maybe then another one about 7. And then it's dead in the day because all the aircraft are out flying and then they come back by the time of the evening again. Changi isn't like that. When you look at the departure list, it's constant. There is a constant flow in and out of Singapore, which led me to just, I couldn't quite believe that I hadn't heard from other travellers that the Jewel doesn't start until 11 a.m., which is preposterous and ridiculous in a 24-hour hub. Secondly, as you said, it was a ghost town. Everything was closed. Then we were there at like 9:10, so we're now there after 9 o'clock in the morning. Everything is still closed, whether it was a grocery store, a high-end designer label, and everything in between, closed. As Dan said, all of the escalators, they were switched off. We struggled. We found ways to get up through different elevators and blah, blah, blah. And we were going through tapes that were like drawn and kind of moving under to have a look. And everywhere we looked, there was like an X, closed. We started to think, is this like, I don't know, is Changi under, is the Jewel under reconstruction? Is it because it's Ramadan? Was it something? Nope, that was the policy. This is the policy every single day. And we were like, what the hell?
Yeah. So then we thought, well, at least the airport itself is fantastic. Let's go through passport control, go to enjoy the lounge, go to maybe browse some cafes, that kind of thing. So we head into Changi Terminal 1, which we were departing from. And I think this is kind of an important detail because we get through. And the first problem was that I had booked a business light ticket, which I do a lot with various airlines, especially Finnair. But in this instance, it was Qatar. And I didn't have access to the Qatar lounge. So what ensued, Alex and Oscar had access to the Qatar lounge. So what ensued was us basically running back and forth through the length of Terminal 1 trying to find a decent lounge that would let us in. We started with Qatar because we thought you might be able to get me in with your status. Nope.
Yeah.
Then we tried Qantas, which also opened at some crazy time in the afternoon.
Yeah.
Which, so that was a no-go. We saw British Airways and we thought we don't want to go there.
So we decide, okay, we don't need to spend time in a lounge because as I had said, we had spoken about how we spend so much time in amazing lounges. Let's just be in Singapore Airside. And you know, Singapore is one of the best airports to transit at. So let's enjoy that, right? So we're in Terminal 1, as you said. And the primary goal, of course, is food. It's breakfast. It's now shortly after 9. Our flight is about 10:30 or so. So let's find somewhere to eat. Well, nobody told me that Terminal 1 at Changi Airport is rubbish. Absolutely rubbish. Dan, did we or did we not walk from the extreme end to the other extreme end and back twice just to give it a fair kind of scope, a fair recce, and concluded, what the hell?
Yeah, and it just kept getting worse because we were so hungry and starting to get stressed because our flight was leaving. So we were just like, surely there is some coffee shop chain we recognize. We just kept passing stalls selling smoked meats, the coffee in a box that wasn't, you know, you couldn't buy fresh coffee, all this stuff. So we're going back and forth and we were just getting more and more frustrated.
Like we were being fussy. You had dropped all requirements. We were like, if we just see anything, even if it was something basic like a Costa, we're like, okay, that would be great.
The only part is that one part toward the windows where there were like a couple coffee shops, but they didn't really have anything to eat, or at least that you wanted to eat. And there was we just wanted grab and go. That is what we were looking for.
No. What did I say when I said, okay, I finally found somewhere that did grab and go, right? So I was like, I'll take anything. And of course, it was predominantly Chinese food. So there was no breakfast, but then I could see they had just the sides of hash brown potato balls. Done.
You're missing part of the story because we finally saw a sign for a food court. So we thought, nice. So we went upstairs expecting a good Asian food court. Singapore is like the king of food courts. We show up there and there's like one Burger King or Subway or something, and this random bubble tea place that had a few snacks, including hash browns. And you were like, yes, hash browns, finally.
Hash browns, done. Something that's breakfast. Yeah. Like I didn't want shredded chili beef. I just wanted something that resembled a bit of breakfast. I was absolutely starving. So I ordered it, paid, fine, waited for the guy to do it. But then I'm trying to remember what was on them. And what was it?
They were covered in curry powder.
That's it, yeah. There were no mention of that on the menu. They were completely covered in curry powder. It was a no from me. They went straight in the trash. What a waste. And I was like, where is Joe and the Juice? Where is Pret? Where is... Don't get me wrong. I don't need these Western named brands. Where are the equivalents in Asia that we had just been enjoying the entire Asia trip? Terminal 1 had nothing. It had a massive Louis Vuitton. It had a massive, you know, Yves Saint Laurent and all of this. But it had absolutely nothing to eat pre-midday. And even the options for after midday looked terrible. We wouldn't have eaten there if it was afternoon.
Yeah.
So by this point, we were worried because the other bit was, we knew that there was likelihood of moderate turbulence for the first bit of the flight. So we were quite sure that there could be a scenario where the crew were unable to serve food. So we didn't want to be in that scenario where we boarded starving and then there's no service for like an hour and a half, 2 hours.
Yes. So what happened, at least I was like, okay, I did not remember Terminal 1 being this useless. I truly thought, in my mind, all the terminals kind of blend together at Changi. But I knew if we go to Terminal 2, which we can walk to, there are grab-and-go spots. Like there is, for example, Pret and Starbucks, those types of things, which don't exist in all of Terminal 1 at Changi. So
There was no grab and go. There was nothing.
Yeah, nothing. And even like, it doesn't have to be, as you said, any Western grab and go. It could literally be like a wok place like you have where you could get stir-fried noodles or fried rice or dumpling. Yeah. Literally just something that you can grab to go, but they don't have that kind of thing. So we had 20 minutes until our gate was closing at this point, and we decided against better judgment, against any advice we would give anyone else, let's walk to Terminal 2, where it says 15 minutes each way, one way to Terminal 2. We are going to walk there, buy something to eat, and come back. So
set the scene, because Terminal 2 is connected to Terminal 1.
Yeah.
But there is a massively long, and the signage says 15-minute walkway of gates connecting the two. There is also like a SkyTrain that takes you through, but we couldn't risk waiting 6 minutes for the SkyTrain and then maybe on the other side, whereas in those 6 minutes we could have been walking. So we didn't take this decision lightly. We were staring at that clock, weren't we, and saying, right, there is 20 minutes until the doors on this Qatar flight that we are all booked on close. Are we as fast walkers able to get to do a 15-minute walk? I was allocating we need to do that in 6 minutes,
right?
And then get food quickly and then don't relax because we've got that same walk all the way back. Is this something that we're going to be okay with? We decided yes. Then we said, no, we can't. Then we were like, fuck it. We've got to.
It was horrible because we wasted another 2 minutes trying to decide. Should we not? Oh, this is really risky, when we should have just gone. So what we do, we decide we are going to race the length of Singapore Changi, and you take off walking faster than I've ever seen. I think you should compete in the walking Olympics. You know that speed thing?
Is there such a thing?
It's a real sport.
Because the bit I liked is you said, firstly, you said to me, I've never seen someone walk so fast in my life. But you also said, but you didn't even look like you were walking fast. Yeah. Like I was, you said to me, you were not flustered or out of breath. I was like,
and you weren't,
yes,
you didn't
that's the whole point.
You didn't look like you were speed walking. You just somehow took off.
Yeah.
And
no one likes that.
You know, I'm tall. I think I walk as fast as you in normal circumstances. You compliment me on this. But on this occasion, you were at least one gate ahead of us within a few seconds. By the end, you were a full, you know, electronic walkway ahead of us when we finally got to Terminal 2 after 7 minutes. So we made it in less than half the time.
And we came off of the walkways because there were too many people standing on them. So for the last four walkways, I was not on them. But look, there was nothing that there are a few things in life that really motivate me, and food is definitely one of them. I was absolutely starving, and I was thinking, if I do not find the energy now to burst through where I know there is going to be decent food, grab and go, so that then the moment we sit down on the aircraft, relax and eat, then I thought, okay, it was exhausting. We did it. You were only about two gates behind me. So by the time I was ordering in prep, I could see you coming off of the last... and we only went to prep because it was the first thing that was there. There were so many other options which we didn't have time to go to.
Yeah. So I sent Oscar to Starbucks in the meantime. He got something there. I got food at Pret. Pret, we of course love. So we got some nice food. And then we linked up with Oscar, and after about 10 minutes, we were on our way back. And as we passed by, we happened to see that the SkyTrain to Terminal 1 was leaving. It said leaving now.
Literally, the door was closing. Yeah. So
we slipped in there, managed to speed the way back without having to get exhausted. And then, of course, we're faced by the final thing that I know I've protected it on the podcast before, but gate side security. Mm-hmm. We had just bought Starbucks and in all the stress and rush to get to the gate,
all this food and forgetting that
and you bought yogurt or some other liquid.
I had the granola with the yogurts and two of them. So I went through security first on the left side and you two went on the right side, and he said to me, no sir, you cannot take that. I said, what, the yogurt? But it's yogurt, I just bought it there. No, you can't take that or that. He pointed at the granola. I was like, okay, he said, you need to go, but we were boarding. He said, you need to go and just go over there and finish it quickly. I said, I can't do this. I need to sit down. Forget it. There's enough. I've got enough other food that's acceptable. Take them, bin them. He was like, are you sure? I said, yeah, bin them. He said, okay, I can't take it off of you. The security officer, who will be the ones to do the pat down if required, they will confiscate it from you. So let it go through the machine. I was like, okay. So I put it through the machine. Nobody says anything. I have my granola and yogurt in hand for the flight.
Yeah, I think
I don't know why they didn't say anything.
After sharing this, you might be the last person to ever get to bring Brett yogurt through security at Changi. But
I don't know. But remember, I don't know if someone had said to him, like, no, it's all right. Or if they forgot.
Yeah. But so the moral of this story is that Singapore Changi has quite a bit of work to do, although they do many things fantastically. They have carpets throughout the terminal to decrease the volume. They have some lovely stores. The terminals look nice. Terminal 2, 3, and 4 are great. They have what you need. But Terminal 1 at Singapore Changi needs to step it up. We need more grab-and-go food. And also... Yeah. Just this is hurting the airport as well, because when you don't have concessions that can sell snacks and drinks for people to take on board the flights, they're selling less. And having gateside security like that means that people can't bring through these casual liquids like Starbucks drinks and whatever onto flights. So when they could potentially sell more to passengers, in the end, because of how the terminal is structured, they can't.
And if you are going to have that small portfolio in Terminal 1 as Singapore Changi does, while being the world's best airport, at least open the Jewel at a sociable, you know, awake hour of 8 a.m. or 9 a.m. or 10, heaven forbid. Don't keep it the whole thing. The fact that the whole thing was closed. So, for example, imagine the couple that have saved up to go on a once-in-a-lifetime trip to Australia, and they have chosen Singapore, led by, you know, influenced by all of the amazing footage of the Jewel and the promotions to visit. And they arrive at 6 a.m. and their next flight is at 9. So they have 3 hours. Well, they're not seeing anything. The Jewel is switched off. It's a complete ghost town. The escalators are switched off. The elevators are turned off. The barriers are out. The everything is closed. It's completely... I find, when you combine that's what we had before, then we went into Terminal 1, and it was absolutely rubbish. And neither of us remembered it being so rubbish, but it now is. And then we were forced to go to T2 and almost miss the flight just so that we don't starve. And then we come all the way back. We sat down in the quad on Q Suite and we were like, this was Singapore? Yeah. In our head, we were so ready for the world's best airport to shine as it has always done so in its global reputation. But I'm sorry, the world's best airport that is asleep until 11 o'clock in the morning, in my idea, is not the world's best airport.
Yeah. When we boarded Q Suite, it was more like, hey now, hey now. This is what when we got our snacks and drinks and we finally, you know, got to be hydrated. So that was our Singapore story for you guys. Sorry it was a bit drawn out, but we just needed to say this, needed to rant a little bit. But oh boy, do we both miss Singapore Airlines, right?
Yeah, Singapore Airlines, that was, the whole trip was just amazing. The trip was absolutely brilliant. And the reason why we felt such a need to, my God, we have to share this, because, you know, we've gone through 100 airports where the food is rubbish and, you know, we don't eat, it's not topical on the podcast, for example, or in conversation. The reason why is because this is Singapore. You know, this is the world's best airport, Changi. And you've got half of it shut, the other half of it without grab and go. You can't find food. You can't find anything, you know. So I think our criticism is warranted, valid, and I hope that they do something about it. And a warning as well to anyone transiting via Terminal 1. Now you know.
Yeah. And of course, Singapore Airlines at least doesn't use Terminal 1. So you know that. It's mostly airlines. So mostly people are flying to or from Singapore using it, which I guess... I don't know. It's still not defensible, but yeah, that's good to be aware of.
Does Scoot use Terminal 1?
Yeah, I think on some flights.
Yeah, because there were a few. I remember when we were racing down that corridor. The gates on our left were going to a few Scoot destinations.
Yeah.
Oh, and also we saw the Scooties walking through the terminal. Remember?
Love a good Scootie. So okay, we have a major topic that we've been wanting to discuss today, and it is all about dear old America. Do you want to take it away?
So our friends in the United States, of course, unless you've been living under a rock, you know what has been happening with all things tariffs. But where the tariffs, and I won't go into the detail because you can Google if you haven't found out exactly what Trump has done and the Trump administration by implementing tariffs on almost every country on earth. What we are specifically keen to discuss is how they are beginning to affect aviation. Once again, aviation right there in the front row when it comes to being hit by whatever economic weapon is being unleashed by a government. And this time it's the US. So firstly, I wanted to ask you, have you ever seen Ferris Bueller's Day Off, the movie?
Of course.
Okay, good. Do you remember the scene where the class are all asleep while the teacher is saying, in 1930, the Republican House of Representatives, in an effort to alleviate from the anyone, and they show their faces, and he says, Great Depression, past the anyone. Do you remember that scene?
No, it's been a while.
Great, okay. I'll just sit here and act the whole thing out. Yeah. God. Right, anyway, there's a scene, right, where the teacher in Ferris Bueller is teaching the kids about how in 1930, the Republican-controlled House passed a bill, the tariff bill, in order to reduce and alleviate the effects of the Great Depression. And the teacher asks the students, did it work in an effort to collect more revenue for the federal government? Anyone? And he says, no, the US sank into deeper into Great Depression. So that's a little side of perhaps maybe this is what, you know, we should look at history as to what could happen. We don't know. But in terms of aviation, this is definitely and factually not good news. Due to the tariffs and the nature of the key components of an aircraft coming from all over the world, in a worst case scenario, we have had the CEO of one of the largest leasing companies globally confirm that these tariffs, such as a 25% tariff, could increase the cost of a 787 by up to $40 million. Some analysts are saying that a 2-3% increase for most aircraft is almost guaranteed. But the rest of the industry is wondering how on earth massive suppliers that are based all over the world are going to be able to import into the US and back out amid what is a complete homegrown tariff trade war that is now going to have a direct impact on if airlines are going to be able to take delivery of aircraft, because those aircraft now cost significantly more than they did yesterday.
So at least so far, the airline CEOs that I see don't think that this will impact aircraft, specifically aircraft deliveries from Boeing or Airbus, just because that would, you know, it would just harm Boeing for not much reason, given that lead times are so big for aircraft orders, that's this type of thing. If you order an aircraft now, assuming there is a new administration in 4 years, the aircraft will be delivered during that administration, not this one.
Correct.
So, you know, that's one part of it. But I think the bigger implications, there's two things to look at, is firstly, of course, the stock market crashing, people's savings being obliterated, hugely raised fears of recession, which always leads to reduced travel demand. So this is one part of a reduction in demand we're seeing, and we're probably going to see more depending on how the economy develops. People can't afford the luxury of a vacation to Europe, or in Europe, they can't afford the luxury of a vacation to the extremely expensive United States of America. That's one part of where I think airlines specifically are very worried. But then the additional part of this is the political side. People who don't want to travel to the US either because they don't support the politics, or there's people who are now increasingly scared of being detained or denied entry to the United States. And we're seeing more and more stories coming out about tourists showing up at the airport in various parts of the US after landing on a long haul trip, their phones being searched or confiscated.
And let's come to that properly, because we've got a few questions about that. So let's actually dedicate a bit more time for that in this episode. But before we move on to that, you're right. On the tariffs, the question about whether or not aircraft will cost more immediately is, of course, not the immediate concern, because these things take time. The key concern with manufacturers is that if you take an aircraft like the 787, which has which relies on components from everywhere, UK, Japan, across Europe, everywhere. Those are affected immediately. Those are immediately facing the tariffs that Trump has imposed, and therefore are of a higher price for both the manufacturer or the supplier obtaining the parts, and therefore, in the end, the customer airline buying and picking up the bill. So that's the concern. It's not that the list price of a 787 or an A350 is going to change tomorrow. No one is suggesting that. But what they are suggesting, and what is a fact, is that these tariffs will affect the suppliers. Some of the most prominent suppliers that supply both Airbus and Boeing have stated over the last 24 hours that they will not import into the US, and that they will simply find other ways, but they will not import to the US because ultimately their margins won't allow them to. It wouldn't be worth their while. That will directly impact deliveries if aircraft are unable to be finished. Combine that with the fact that we're already in a supply chain crisis and a spare parts crisis, and that nobody around the world, big or small, can get aircraft deliveries because of the state that everything is in since a couple of years ago. We're in a mess.
Yeah, that's a very good point. Do you know how this will impact, for example, so of course you're saying the price of parts will go up. What about aircraft that are actually produced in the US, like Airbus aircraft, for example, that are produced in the US compared to China, compared to Europe? Because surely this will lead to further complexity now that the US part has tariffs, Airbus, the aircraft are being produced on US soil, but it's a foreign company. I understand if we don't quite know this yet, but I'm interested.
So I wanted to read you this. So there is an aircraft supplier, Howmet, and they supply, they're based, I believe, in Pittsburgh. Well, I'm just going to double check that here. Let's see. Yes, Pittsburgh. Yes, so they are based. So Howmet supplies to both Airbus and Boeing, right? They have signaled that they will suspend some shipments, US-bound shipments, if they are impacted by the tariffs that US President Donald Trump announced just recently. So they're waiting this week, and you know, we're still a little bit early on into the week, but I think even by the time this episode goes out, by the way, there may be a development here. Howmet, who supply both Airbus and Boeing with key aircraft parts, said in a letter to its customers that it had declared a legal practice that will now allow parties to a contract to avoid their obligations if they are hit by the unavoidable, an unpredictable and sudden external circumstance tariffs, such as those being imposed by the United States. In simple terms, Dan, to answer your question, it looks like that if you are a manufacturer with the final assembly line or manufacturing aircraft outside of the United States, naturally you're going to be in a better position. It is these fragile, you know, suppliers that are incredibly dominant but have struggled over recent years to get anything out that are now looking at this as one almighty financial headache and thinking it's just not worth it. And a lot of people think that Airbus and Boeing are completely different, and that's why many people think that when Boeing were having really bad days, it's to Airbus's delight and vice versa. And we've spoken before, haven't we, about how that is not the case. It is in both manufacturers' interests that each other are strong, not least because they share so many of the same suppliers. The commonality between the two is immense. And this is an example of one of their largest suppliers that supplies both Airbus and Boeing, basically saying that they would suspend many of their shipments to the US because of the tariffs. Therefore, benefiting if you are assembling outside the US, which the likes of Airbus, of course, do, but also Airbus have set themselves up in China, in Tianjin. They've got a final assembly line in Hamburg. Aircraft come out of Toulouse. The group has got the military side in Spain. You've got key parts being manufactured across Germany and so on. And the same can be said to an extent for Boeing when it comes to parts. But in terms of assembly, that's a homegrown American jet.
Yeah, very good point. One thing is for sure, Airbus, people have been telling them for years they need to expand their production capacity in France and Germany. They could expand both at Toulouse Airport and Hamburg. Airlines are not seeing the number of deliveries they want. And I think increasingly now, we're seeing more and more challenges that mean that we need more production capacity from Airbus because there's clearly a lot of demand for Airbus jets.
That's not because Airbus have sat back and said, no, we're satisfied. That is because, yes, Airbus can, for example, convert one of the existing hangars like they did with the A380 when they ended production, and they converted it into a production line for the A321. That's all very nice and well, but if the spare parts are not flowing in, not just the spare parts, if the parts are not arriving because of the supply chain crisis, you're stuck.
Yeah, that's a good point. I mean, just looking at their stock, Airbus stock has actually gone down more than Boeing in the past month. Airbus is down 15%, Boeing is down 11%. So we have that. Then we have, you know, a bigger contrast looking at Delta's stock, because airlines in the US are really somewhere to look when it comes to people's concerns about travel demand. And both United and Delta have gone out and said, okay, we're not quite seeing the results we expected for this year. And, you know, that's before we actually see the financial results. Delta is down 30% in 1 month, their stock. So obviously that's concerning. We have United choosing to retire several aircraft. They haven't specified exactly which ones yet, but they have quite a bit of flexibility in their fleet and they have a lot of very old aircraft. So they're choosing to withdraw a few from service opportunistically. But I just think it's, you know, it's very interesting to look here. The first place we spoke about on the podcast where we're seeing a reduction in demand is between the US and Canada. And I think this is more the case of a boycott where Canadians don't really want to travel to the US. We've seen the boycott work with Tesla's stock, where people have boycotted Tesla. Their stock is down 50% from its peak. United, for example, has made major changes to their summer schedule to Canada. They canceled planned service from Los Angeles to Toronto. They're reducing service by several daily frequencies between Washington and Montreal, Washington and Ottawa. They have a few new services other than that. Then we have WestJet cutting a few US routes. Let's see which ones we have there. This is per Aero Routes, canceling Calgary to New York LaGuardia, canceling Edmonton to Orlando, reducing frequencies on other routes, Delta cutting down as well on certain routes. So there have been conflicting reports on what exactly the reduction in demand has been. We had sort of a bombshell that was released from OAG, which compiles data about airline demand patterns, future bookings, and that concerned people a lot. They said here that bookings between April and September between the US and Canada are down 70% compared to this time last year, which is, of course, basically worse than we saw during COVID.
And I, you know, anecdotally, you know that I was just in Canada, and my friends that I'd spoken with there were telling me that the US was 100% part of their travel plans for this year, and it's now not. And so hearing that, I was thinking, okay, this 70% thing is beginning to make sense, because of course loads of Canadians would go to Maine, right? That's where that's where a lot will have some downtime, have second homes and so on. Also to Florida. And that's just not happening. This is what my friends were also kind of showing, that they are taking that stance too. Secondly, you go into all of the supermarkets and everyone is encouraging you to buy Canadian, and people are actively not buying American. And as you say, these things are very easily evident in air travel. What I did find interesting are these two comments. One, the CEO of Accor, the hotel group, had said that European interest in travel to the US was waning. He said he could see a decline. In fact, there is a 25% drop in bookings from Europeans who would have typically booked to go to the US this summer. 25% is huge. We are talking convene the emergency business continuity, you know, team to discuss how they get those 25% back. Are attitudes shifting? Is it social media? Are people hearing about what we said about, you know, people are arriving to the border and they're saying, can you unlock your phone? We want to go through it. And legally, you have to let them, you know, all of this stuff. That's the first comment. The second comment, Virgin Atlantic. We very rarely hear from them in terms of their global outlook. We hear that they launched a route here and that they launched a route there. And then we hear a few months later that they canceled those routes. So that's kind of Virgin Atlantic. God. It's true.
The shade. Right? I know it is true.
So Virgin Atlantic say that they have also observed early signs of, quote, declining U.S. demand for transatlantic flights. This is interesting. I do not see Virgin Atlantic willingly reporting this unless it was something as clear as day. This is an airline that only just became profitable. They finally reported a profit for 2024 of £20 million. I am sure the department concerned for the outlooks and the strategy were toing and froing as to whether or not they want to be the airline to admit that demand has fallen in that way. But they did, which I think we should read a lot into.
It's especially significant for an airline like Virgin Atlantic to be the one to break the news about a softening in transatlantic demand, because that is their whole market. They are literally have Atlantic in their name. Yep. Yes. So for them to say this year reduction is huge. And I think that a lot of airline CEOs don't want to freak people out. They don't want to freak investors out. They don't want to, you know, show too much concern before we actually have concrete numbers. Because of course, with air travel, people book quite far in advance. So this summer, a lot of people have already booked their trips. Maybe they booked those in January, December, or even last fall. So the real thing we'll be looking at is this fall, this winter, when demand already goes down in normal cases. This year, we can expect that to be even more significant. What I found really interesting about the comments from Virgin Atlantic is that the reduction they are seeing is from the US market, US point of sale, not a UK point of sale, which maybe isn't what we would have expected.
But if you look at, I mean, if you turn on the US daytime shows, and I had some of them on while I was working in the background in Canada, they were really pushing how everyday Americans are now no longer considering their vacations. They're no longer considering the luxuries that they were considering this time last year or the year prior, because they feel that they are worse off, or whether they are or not is a whole separate matter, and we're not going to get into that. But the daytime shows were at least kind of pushing, and I don't just mean the daytime shows on the left, you know, I understand there are agendas and biases. Even Fox on the right had a segment about travel demand really softening, airline CEOs being really concerned. It was a Fox Business report about basically trying to get the US carriers to admit, are we in a bad place? Are we in a bad place? And you know that they're just waiting for one to confirm, a bit like what the Accor CEO said, a bit what Virgin Atlantic has said. And then suddenly the viewer who heard that is already thinking, maybe this isn't the time for the, you know, $8,000 big family Europe trip, even if they're not affected by the tariffs. It's a real big psychological thing at play here.
Yeah, and let's not underplay how significant travel is for the US economy. Of course, in Europe as well, tourism is incredibly important, but Canada has a population of about 30 million people. If there is a 10% drop in Canadian visitors to the United States, that will lead to a $2.1 billion loss in spending and 14,000 job cuts per the U.S. Travel Association. So here, 10%. And we had OHG stating that we'd seen a 70% reduction in bookings. So you can imagine the economic impact. The
70% spans most of the year as well. Like they were talking about the bulk of the year. You know, this is something we need to keep an eye on. This is incredibly significant. And as we said, if it wasn't, you wouldn't have quieter airlines that are built around the transatlantic model like Virgin Atlantic admitting it in the same announcement where they're saying, hey guys, we're profitable for the first time in ever, you know, for the first time in such a long time.
Yep. We will keep an eye on this, I'm sure, in the coming weeks. Yeah. As we get into this summer, we're going to hear more. Yeah, absolutely not. But on that note, let's go into Q&A. This is something I think about a lot. Kenji asks us, love your podcast and your videos. I was wondering if I could ask a question for the podcast. Yes, you can. Which airline would you recommend for flying business class in for the first time?
Ooh.
And here you need to be strategic. I was very strategic with Oscar because I was like, don't go straight to
Qatar. You don't want
to
ruin.
Don't go straight to SQ. You need to start low. So the first business class flight I ever took Oscar on was Iceland Air Saga class.
That is strategic, like the armchair.
Yeah, and he loved it. He was like, whoa, this is so luxurious. The food, the space. Then I took him on United, which I feel is a good next step to taste a nice seat. So you want to work your way up, is my opinion.
That's a good idea. I'm aligned with that. That's a really good idea. Got a question here from Max. Hi, Alex. Love the podcast with Dan. I was just recently flying from Vienna to Amsterdam on Austrian Airlines, operated by Air Baltic. They're everywhere, aren't they? Everywhere except Latvia. Anyway, after we were at cruising altitude, they made an announcement and said that there was an issue with the catering in Vienna and it was completely missing. I was wondering if the people in business had any right to compensation, as the difference between economy and business is mainly the onboard food. Greetings from Rotterdam. Greetings to you, Max, in Rotterdam. The people do have a right, yes, because it was part of the promise when they took the contract out with the airline by pressing pay now for that business class flight. So they would have had to have been compensated by Air Baltic. How much?
By Austrian, I guess, in this case.
By Austrian. How much depends and varies between airlines and where you are and so on. But yes, if you were on that flight and that was part of the deal and they were unable to fulfill that part of the agreement, then you have a right to get in touch with them and get some form of compensation. Whether or not it was in a refund, a voucher, an upgrade, miles, is kind of a negotiation between yourself and the airline.
Yeah, good point. So KJ asks, loving the podcast as usual. I asked a question to Alex previously, so I thought it's only fair to ask you this time. Cool. So there have been quite a number of airline rebranding exercises in the past couple of years with a focus on wanting to be more premium, with Korean Air being the latest one. However, I can't help but think they're all just taking the easy way out in terms of actually building their brand. It's like if the airline executives woke up one morning and felt that they wanted to be more fancy and then throw a lavish rebranding event announcing they're going to be... they're going to partner with X brand for tableware and Y brand for amenity kits, expecting people to flip a switch in their head and magically believe that they are now a luxury airline. In contrast, it took decades of advertising, marketing, and brand building for airlines like SQ, Qatar, and Emirates to get where they are today. Would love to know your and Alex's thoughts on this. Thanks and keep up the great work.
I think that's an excellent question. And I think you are spot on. There is this hope from many kind of third tier, second tier carriers that if they quickly get, you know, Dolce & Gabbana home on board and they quickly get a new menu, then that's it. We're just like them. We did it. You know, let's hope that no one notices that we're still the same. I think you're right. I think these things take time. And I think there are a lot of airlines hoping that they can rush it. And these things can't be rushed. So I am in agreement. I think that these things are the same way trust is earned from the passenger. The perception of what is true premium will not just happen because you splash the cash on collabs with big household brand names, for example.
Yeah, I think an interesting example to look at is Air France, because they are doing everything on paper to make the onboard experience and the lounge experience, I guess, as premium as they can for a European airline. They just announced they're introducing mattress pads on all wide-body flights in business, which is great. They already are introducing great seats across their fleet, reconfiguring quite fast. Just a lot of things are going right. But the thing that most airlines miss that sets Qatar, Emirates, and SQ apart, and that we asked at Korean Air and couldn't get an answer to because it was completely ignored, is what is it in the crew training that you are changing? Because that is a huge part of being a premium brand so many companies seem to overlook. You can't introduce... Yeah. You know, Armani tableware and a mattress pad and have flashy seats if your crew doesn't know how to perform luxury upscale service. So, and you have some level of consistency and quality. So for all these airlines looking to become more premium, they also need to actually teach their crew, spend more than a day where you just teach them how to, you know, pour up the coffee and stuff. Spend time teaching them body language, teaching them this is the service flow of each flight where we maybe introduce ourselves to premium passengers. And in economy, for example, doing something, Singapore Airlines hands out hot towels. Emirates has paper menus and they come around with their Polaroids offering passengers to take pictures. It's small things like that where you see the crew more before boarding, even in economy class, that makes you feel like, okay, they're doing a little bit extra. This is the type of thing all these airlines that say they want to be premium are not looking into, not doing. And that's where they, I think, where they miss. Because ultimately, what people do is they go home and they tell other people, whoa, I just flew Emirates and it was so luxurious. They gave us ice cream mid-flight and we had paper menus.
These are the things people remember.
Yeah.
Yeah. You're spot on. And also, if an airline like Air France have all these ambitions, which they clearly do in wanting to ensure that you as a passenger associate them with a premium airline, look no further than a few days ago, I had to transit via Barcelona and I'm watching the gate agents who Air France appoint to handle the Paris flight. And they are doing everything but preparing for boarding for this flight. They're gossiping, they're ignoring every passenger, they're laughing amongst themselves, they're showing each other things on their phones, and then they press a button to an automated thing that said that the flight is now open for boarding, and they look away and they're pointing at people to go and use the automated the boarding pass scanners to board. There was such resentment in their attitude, such hostility. Now I understand they were not direct employees of Air France, but the fair paying public don't understand that. They are appointed by Air France, and therefore, if you're going to uphold these premium values, you need to ensure that everyone is on the same page.
Yes. Amazing. We are so happy we got to join you guys this Wednesday again. We look forward to seeing you next Wednesday here on air. You can now start submitting your questions directly to our On Air with Dan and Alex account on Instagram. That's a great place to send them, so that both of us will receive them. And don't forget, as always, to follow us there and to leave a review of the podcast. It helps us out so much, wherever you're listening.
That's a good point. I was going to say, make sure you're following that Instagram. It's having a nice little growth spurt now. So we want to keep it going. So thank you guys as well for joining us, and we will see you next week on air.
You stole my part. Bye bye.
See you later.